This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Saxo Market Call. We are recording this on Monday, 2nd of May, just before the U.S. open here. So in case a lot has happened over the time before we're putting this out on Tuesday morning, the 3rd, just for that realization, we have with us our special guest, Stein Jakobsen from Saxo, Chief Investment Officer, Chief Economist. So glad to get you on this program. We wanted to do a special edition because there's an awful lot going on, and we wanted a chance to have a longer form conversation than the daily, just sort of the daily update, the daily grind here. So Stein, welcome, of course, first of all. And I think one place to start is an area we've talked about quite a bit and discussed quite a bit on internal calls. And that is, if we look at a thing like the equity market itself, the U.S. equity market, there are a lot of headlines, I think somewhat disingenuous, these headlines. It's the worst start to the year since whatever decade in the past. Of course, they're cherry picking year to date to this date. As we look back at the pandemic year, of course, the drawdown was far worse up to that point in early March or whatever it was. And by many measures, market sentiment is really, really in the dumps, almost to a historic degree. Some of these weekly surveys at worse levels than in 2009. Should we be looking at this as a contrarian buying opportunity, or what's going on here with sentiment and why the market is having such a hard time finding its feet?
Well, John, you know, I'm not a guy who is very much in love with surveys and people being asked questions with no accountability on them. But basically, from my chair, I think we see week after week a continuation of the same trend. And that trend itself, as we said many times, both in your podcast, but also in the special program, started in November last year when the Federal Reserve reversed policy from one which was accommodative and where there was no material impact from inflation from that policy. That was changed 180 degrees because of the pivot that happened through the White House putting pressure on the Federal Reserve and the Federal Reserve then caving in and changing the whole rhetoric. That was the high in sentiment. That was the high in valuation in overall terms for the global market. And that was the starting point for the acceleration of the dollar strength that we see now. I think everything else that happened is a derivative of that decision. I know the market seems to think that there is a cycle, there is an incoming recession, there is a slowdown, an upgrade, a downgrade, and all this. But to me, I think the framework or the overall frame defines what's going on. The reason Warren Buffett coming off this weekend is the richest man in the world is that he put a pedal to the metal in terms of just living in a multiple decade environment of lower inflation and lower policy rates. Now that is unclear at best. At worst, we have a 1970 scenario that needs to see the world move to a much tighter financial condition index that we have today. And that's basically where I am at. Having put the framing place, what is the medium short term for me is the two following major points. One is that the liquidity situation in the world is turning over, the most cruel and easiest one to monitor. And I know Yadani does a great job of monitoring that. But if you take the major four central banks and their balance sheet, that is now, as we speak today, John, moving into a negative from a year-over-year growth of 40% last year. Of course, that will have an impact on the market, but it is the extension of what is incoming in terms, as you already alluded to. Bank of England is going to do QT this week. It's a small open economy. They have the worst inflation. They have the biggest slowdown in the economic sense. So it's becoming sort of the laboratory for QT policy, which of course the Fed will deliver later this week. And the second point is that the financial conditions, despite having moved about 150 basis points, and remember the direct translation of being up 150 basis points in tightening is that in real terms, that means that growth should be 150 basis points lower, but the expected growth rate is still 2.25%. And as such, this talk about recession is not only early, but probably also wrong in the sense that having the amount of private capital, the balance sheet of the private sector is the best ever. So that means at a bare minimum, there will be a slow grinding. So for me, you fade the hard recession in the US, and you certainly, in case of Europe, also probably fade the severe depression that people are expressing in terms of what goes on. And if you do that, you end up with a world where the inflation is not transitory, but structural. And the most likely scenario is actually both that the forward guidance, the terminal rate, the end rate at which Fed needs to stop is higher, but also that the inflation cost to that is higher. And as such, John, I see the market reflecting that pretty normally. The dispersion, as you indicate, is wide, probably the widest I've ever seen in my career, but that's because we have split the world into a tangible assets, a real asset, and these forward-looking, at best, fantasy scenarios of companies making money.
Well, you answered just about questions 2, 3, and 4 on my list here with that statement. It's very useful framework for looking at what we're looking at here, and especially as we go into this FOMC meeting, we've seen a pretty steady stream of hawkish Fed surprises ever since you mentioned those November acceptance speeches for renomination of Powell and the promotion of Brainard to the vice chair. We saw an interesting reaction around the mid-March FOMC meeting, which did seem to surprise on the hawkish front. And yet the market seemed to sort of refind its feet. The equity market seemed to find its feet a bit and rallied for quite some time until this latest sell-off. So, you know, obviously this is tactical versus where we are for the longer cycle. And I think the latter is what you've generally expressed on where the Fed may yet go. Do you think there's any chance that they underdeliver this week relative to where the market has taken its expectations? We're priced, after all, for a 50 basis point move here at this meeting and for multiple 50 basis point moves. A Fed funds rate that you talked about the terminal rate, but just if we take it sort of more short term into the end of this year, priced for 2.75% to 3%, that would take it well above, of course, the cycle high back from 2018. And do you think that rate message, given what you just said about the balance sheet aspect of all of this, do you think actually the emphasis could be more on maybe not rates themselves, but maybe on it's the whole balance sheet side of things that is in the driver's seat? So do you expect this $95 billion per month that's been thrown around, or what are you expecting from this week's meeting sort of specifically?
I think the whole FOMC is queued up to deliver the same kind of speech. I think that was exemplified by Williams of the New York Fed, which of course is the most important Federal Reserve institution inside the system, because of course it's the executing branch of the Federal Reserve in Washington. But what he said was that he very likely, he thought 50 basis point was the right amount, and he also thought initiating the slowdown of and the reduction of the balance sheet along the lines of the $95 billion a month, 60 plus 35 in terms of what goes on. And then more importantly for me, he talks about the fact that the Federal Reserve needs to move the real rates into a different place for where it is today. And real rates today, of course, effectively, if you take the actual inflation and the actual interest rate is running at minus 600, minus 500. And that remains my number one objective on both recession and forward-looking guidance. You know, even if we move away from where the implicit inflation, implicit GDP is 1 year from now, and the implicit interest rate, you know, 1 year forward from now, most of the market expect that the terminal rate or the final rate that the Fed funds goes to, let's call it 2.75% in your words. But inflation is most likely to be about 4% roughly. That means that at the end of the next 12-month cycle, we are still running a negative 125 to minus 75 basis point, which, you know, if zero is the normal real interest rate that is accommodative, it is super accommodative relative to the cycle. And I think that point is to a large extent lost on the market. I think that's what kept some of the insiders long equity for a very long time, but now they are adjusting that view relatively to, in my opinion, a wrong assumption of growth destruction that goes on in the world. And the reason why we know it's growth destruction is actually your space, John. As you know, internal meetings have been extremely bearish on sterling and on Aussie, because I see them as small open economies with a very high delta or exposure to the rest of the world and what goes on. And of course, the major disappointment, everything being equal this year, has been China, the zero COVID policy that remains in place and actually looks to be extending even at this time of the year and this part of the cycle. So for me, short term, a little bit of adjustment on growth. I don't think Fed sees that in their models. What they do see is that everything being equal with Ukraine and China pushing on a string, the supply strain constraints, it's more likely than not they're going to be wrong on the 12 months outlook on inflation, and they may need to increase that. And as such, their policy becomes more accommodative relatively to what the market thinks. So in other words, forget about the 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, the competition that goes on in calling the highest amounts of nominal. What is really interesting is the real rates, and underneath that, the far most important thing is liquidity is drying up left, right, and center, which means that the stock of collateral in the world is going down. And that means that we are moving assets, we are cross-referencing, we are cross-moving assets in and out of the least liquid ones, which is private equity, it is credit space, it is something like ARG investments and stuff like that. So I think the signs, you know, you have to be very careful to be thinking that you got everything under control. But, you know, in a week by week macro analysis, I think the market is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. And the main story is still the Fed is way behind, and they're actually more behind that even they think they are behind.
Yeah. And you also see this liquidity angle on things. I put the title of my FX update today was illiquidity and its discontents, because you see an interesting reaction function in some of the smaller developed market currencies, something like the Australian dollar you mentioned, where for the rate cycle, we have an RBA tonight. We don't know what's going to happen there. But the market priced for a pretty aggressive series of rate hikes through the end of this year, as we get the coming wage information, et cetera. And actually the spread of 2-year rates has gone in the Australian dollar's favor and is close to the highs for the year versus US 2-year rates. We also saw last week a very hawkish Swedish Riksbank, expected to tilt hawkish. It tilted even more hawkish than expected, and it got respect for about 2 hours. And now we have the Euro Swedish krona rate back to new highs locally here. So in other words, the move not sticking. And that liquidity angle, I think, is important. Is there a systemic risk at some point, regardless of what the Fed needs to do to get real rates where they need to go, to have an impact on the economy, to have an impact on inflation? Do you see any systemic risk angle from the U.S. dollar, something in the plumbing of the system that some have worried about in the past that could, require some sort of adjustments to what's going on here for financial system concerns rather than what's appropriate for the economy?
It's pretty clear, and I think I made the point before, if you only use one proxy for liquidity in the world, you should use the dollar index. And if you use that as a proxy right now in a one-dimensional system, you have the dollar at all-time high. So, of course, liquidity is tight. And, of course, this is having functional impact on the flow of funds, especially in emerging market, but also, again, in high leverage economies, which have open economies like Sweden, UK, and Australia, and you see that impact. But I think to a large extent, why these central banks are not getting credit is that the market has realized there are two ways to look at a central bank. It is one, what they say they will do, and two, what they actually deliver. And I think in case of both the risk bank, in Panga, Bank of England, and in RBA, they talk a much more hawkish game than they actually delivered. Whereas I think the market perceive the Federal Reserve in a situation where they have no choice but to move. So you can say, and I think this is even embedded into the language of the different central banks. In the US, you talk about an automation of process. It is a mechanical way of doing it. They like to have a process which is predictable and the like. So I think it's the difference between being mechanical, predictable in the case of the US, which means they have to deliver it, whereas in the risk bank and Bank of England and RBA and a number of other central banks, it's very much talk about maybe potentially doing it. And Bank of England has And the governor Bailey has been very, very good at changing his mind almost to an extent that he looks like an amateur politician.
Yeah, and I would say you can also have a sense of the Bank of England holding its nose while it's hiking rates, because it is seeing this cost of living crisis coming barreling down. You also have the fiscal the cliff essentially in the UK post the pandemic response, et cetera. Also such limitations on the supply side in the UK from Brexit, which took away, you know, portions of the labor force. So there's just not the ability to expand the economy in a real sense when your labor pool has shrunk, even if you did want to stimulate. So the UK is, I agree, is pretty much in the worst of all worlds in terms of speed limiters on its economy. That plus is exploding trade deficit from the energy side, from the impact of the war in Ukraine is really ugly to witness here. I'm a bit surprised how little actually the pound has fallen if you look at some of the crosses, but we'll see how that shapes up after this week's BOV, et cetera. Speaking of course, we need to talk about it. I think it's a rather opaque situation in terms of what will happen next, but that is the ongoing impact of the war in Ukraine. We have a major date coming up here that could see some sort of announcement from the Russian side, this May 9th, date, which is the celebration of the end of World War II. It's a huge national moment yearly in Russia. There's been a lot of noise in the headlines on what some are anticipating Putin might do. What are you looking for here, just overall for the situation? I don't want to pin you to making any predictions or about May 9th specifically, but what are you looking at here for in terms of next steps?
Yeah, so I spent a very negative weekend because the only thing I did was listen to podcasts which predicted that we were already in World War III. And just for the record, I disagree with all arguments and all the arguments from the people, from Pippa Malgram to Peter Seifan to Mike Green and McMaster, the former security advisor. So I listened to all this and trying to understand what sort of get these people to use a headline that to me is probably the most scary headline you can embed into a piece of research. But what they're really saying is that the theater or the way we conduct ourselves in terms of war and the whole narrative is really being fought today, mainly on technology, in communication terms and in space. So, you know, whereas the Russia clearly knows that they have no ability to confront at least the American forces on conventionally in terms of fighting a classic sort of world war as we did in World War I and World War II, they are moving the agenda over to a sphere where they can control the narrative. And that whole fear, of course, is to undermine the democratic values and the system in Europe. And to be honest, from a objective chair, I think it's been pretty easy to point your fingers at democracy in Europe, the way we finance ourselves, the way we conduct ourselves, and how populism has become embedded. And of course, they have been a vehicle to support that, both in a monetary sense, but certainly also in terms of the propaganda enlightenment. And I think, as you point out, the victory day on May 9th is such a day where Russia will show its full might in that space. And that's why I sort of gave it a long lead in. I don't think it's likely that they will increase the conventional army and projection that they do, but I do think that there is some initiative either on the, you know, let's call it the Haga side or on the narrative side, that in order to, number one, safeguard the message that goes to the domestic audience in Russia to sort of to get a mobilization going again, and secondly to explain to the rest of the world that we believe ourselves to be deterred against that force, which is a force, in their opinion, the voice of Russia, is a force that wants to break up the Russia again and make a piecemeal of it. And inside that sits, of course, the whole pivot point, two pivot points from China. First, they embedded fully a full operational cooperation with Russia, and now they are backtracking on that on a daily basis, trying to get away from it. But basically, the geopolitical pieces today are put up in the air, and when they're put up in the air, you see a number of small incursions in internet, you know, the cutting off the communication in Svalbard, whatever. All these are being used as proxy for why World War III started. I think it's probably more standard common practice on a daily basis what goes on, but it comes to the forefront in terms of what goes on right now, John. But for me, I'm very nervous about this inflection point because I think it's politically driven, and I think it sits inside this new geopolitical picture, which is that we fight in space, we fight in on the internet, and we fight in information rather than in conventional. You know, of course, it's a good thing we don't fight as much in conventional sense, but you know, I don't think anyone sees the war in Ukraine not having shed human lives that shouldn't have been shed, and it's still a tragedy of enormous proportion that in 2022 we need to do and go to war to fight for what we believe in. So no, for me this is an inflection point, and it could be the maximum inflection point in terms of the noise that goes on. And just for the record, you know, I have my 100-year portfolio, and part of that is being long volatility, and that is finally breaking out. The mid-curve ETF I use for that exposure is breaking to the upside inside an environment where the market is still orderly, but the volatility component of that portfolio seems to be kicking in right now at a time where I also see increase in nervous intention.
There's also speaking to that portfolio, there's also a trend following approach on commodities, if I'm not mistaken. And on that front, we have to look at not only energy prices, which I've seen quite a structural reset here, but global food prices. And this is where the, you know, sort of speculation of what could come next becomes least comfortable, because we are seeing what could be the seeds of a food crisis, some of it linked to the food crops themselves. Of course, a lot of those disruptions in Ukraine as a major wheat exporter, as a major cooking oil exporter, but also in terms of fertilizer production, because a lot of that takes place in different components in different places. So some of it is natural gas driven. Obviously, some of that's been shut down. It will also mean, because of higher prices, that the application of fertilizer might be somewhat reduced, and therefore the gains or the yields on crops will be reduced. But there's also the diesel front. There's also just some of the fertilizers themselves on a mineral basis or in Belarus or in from Russia themselves with it, if it's phosphate production. Isn't the risk here when you're looking at a consumption basket and suddenly the one portion of that basket, whether it's energy or food and combined, that occupies or takes up an increasing portion of the basket, doesn't it drop the overall real growth in the economy? And this has to be what eventually, I guess, pushes back eventually on some of the inflationary pressures. Or how are we supposed to look at that? Or does that all get subsidized away by accommodative governments that just need to subsidize cost of living for the most vulnerable? Well, take us through the moving parts there in your mind.
It's very much a developing world phenomena, because one, the food and energy component of an emerging market is in all cases almost always a north of 25%, whereas for you and I, John, it's just a nuisance that we have to pay the equivalent of €2 for a liter of gasoline. So I think the impact is very, very different. I also think that from the private sector balance sheets perspective, there is an ability to shield some of that impact in the short term. But it doesn't mean that, you know, when you look at headlines from some of the tabloids in the UK, they talk about energy poverty being, of course, that a rising number of households in the UK cannot afford to pay for the energy, and the energy increases, despite the fact that energy in the UK is actually regulated, at least on the gas side. So I think it's becoming more of a political issue than a practical issue in the Western world, but I think very much the opposite in the developing nations, where the food and energy carry sign in the case of burning and making food, of course, in a country like India, is becoming a central part of the narrative and the drivers of the market. And that will take increased amount of fiscal spending in the emerging markets, but also in the Western world. We've seen early stage of that in France and UK, and even in Denmark, we've apparently coming up with a plan to substitute some of that. And of course, what happens when the only thing you do is to support the demand side of the equation and don't look at the supply side, of course, you're going to increase the amount of inflation in the system and the pipeline from this, all from good initiative and wanting to do the right thing. But it's very short-sighted and probably accelerates the price of energy and food further. And as you say, the world needs to look at the whole supply side of fertilizers, of the components that go into semiconductors, neon, all of these small components that we have been used to has been delivered just in time. Now it's not even a matter of whether you get them on any time, it's actually whether you get it delivered at all. So I think as the world progresses in Ukraine, a number of resources that fits into the mix of what Russia also have many means that the world is short of 5 to 10% of all commodities. And as such, John, the food component is also playing on that very theme, which means to me that we, from a strategic point of view, from a bottom-up perspective, sits in front of the most challenging, both political, but even worse, economic times over the next 12 months, where either we use this as a platform for change or we get riots and revolution beginning at the end of the cycle.
All right. And that's... It's some concerning aspects there, to say the least. And there was also that story, I think we trotted it out on the daily podcast, talking about that some of the Chinese tech for their electric vehicles, so EV batteries, uses iron phosphate technology. These are the ones going into the Chinese Teslas, for example. And phosphate has a fertilizer application as well. So EV batteries, ironically, competing with food fertilizer. But speaking of China, we need to have, I just want to get it for a final comment from you, your thoughts on where China is in the cycle. It's in such a different place than, for example, the U.S. With these lockdowns, a service society of the economy has been very, very constrained. And then, of course, these snarled supply chains from this zero COVID policy. It's very opaque. But where do you think China sits here in terms of policymaking, in terms of potentially adding to global demand, if and when they get to the other side of this COVID bump here, if you will? And then just where it sits in terms of the deglobalization risks, whether those are linked to policy towards Russia or otherwise, or just in general, the world having learned that it's a bit of a pain to have supply chains in China because of the risks of COVID lockdowns, risks of this or sanctions or tariffs or what have you.
Let's start with the last part of the question, which is the sort of could China be impacted by sanctions similar to Russia? Well, at least in the mind of the Chinese, this is having some probability, because over the weekend we saw Caijing, which is one of the more public website and news service in China, coming out with a story that last week the PBOC called in all of the major banks in order to create a rescue or plan for if and when and then should it happen that they were similar to Russia, were taking up the SWIFT, what would be the preparedness, what would be the action that needs to be taken. So at least in the mind of this planned economy, they are contemplating what could happen. When I talk to Chinese insiders and today it is increasingly difficult to get anyone to commit to anything under the circumstances. But it's pretty clear to me that between the lines, the single biggest issue that business people and finance people in China deals with is whether down the line that China, through this full commitment to Russia and a continued support, at least in the public space, is going to see ramification from this if the war continues to extend in Ukraine and the U.S. commits, as it looks like, more and more weaponry, but also both practical and political support for Ukraine, whether that can have a backlash. So it's pretty clear that is the number one concern for Chinese companies and Chinese operators and people who live in sort of the real Chinese economy. If we then move over to sort of the China scene from the chair of Xi Jinping, it's absolutely clear that his proudest moment until very recently was the COVID zero policy. The COVID policy has been sold to the Chinese population as the savior, at how China did it differently and how China did it better and how China recovered better from implementation of that policy. What is now happening in an objective term, at least, is that this is piece by piece falling apart because, of course, the ability of the Chinese vaccine to deal with the new strains of the COVID is, it seems to be limited. And as such, they have an increased problem on the hand, which sits right in front of the single most important political event in the Chinese calendar, which of course is the extension of the third term to President Xi and making him lifetime president of China, which of course is a semi-violation of the old rule of only sitting for two periods, but also a cementation of the new sort of found Mao Trotsky version of the communist interpretation that he wants to do. So there's a big disconnect between the narrative that the zero COVID policy is one of the major achievements of the Chinese party and the fact that he needs to get reelected inside and more practically the tricycle is then the third wheel, of course, being this ability to sanction. If you solve for that, I think it's pretty clear that ultimately, the end game here for China is to not publicly, but softly, probably abandon the zero policy. But that will only, in my opinion, happen after he's been solidified and elected. And that process is unofficially supposed to happen in June, July. And then the announcement comes at a party conference in September, October. But in practical terms, it should be finished by June. So I expect a ramp up, significant ramp up, economic activity, infrastructure spender, and all that as we come into the late summer and becoming more aggressive as we go out of the year, because it is becoming very, very obvious that these lockdowns is having a significant impact negatively on the growth rate. A number of commentators now talking about the real rate growth in China being 1 to 2% at best versus the 5.5% projected. But of course, you can find any version of that, because you remember the GDP growth in China, I think, is accurate, but it's accurate on a five-year average period. So it's not precise inside a year, but over 5 years is probably correct. But right now, it's definitely undershooting. So for me, John, it's the policy response is clear. A soft abandonment of zero policy on COVID and ultimately an increase in infrastructure. So, you know, having said that, it's probably the worst of the worst is probably upon us right now. And it's going to be maximized between in the month of May in terms of negative. And then probably I'm a better buyer of China than I'm a seller, basically just because the system will then start to kick in, which is, you know, essentially a closed system.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens there. You have these, you've got some headlines purporting to show Xi Jinping calling for a very unspecified, but very clearly calling for a huge infrastructure build out push. So you've seen the Chinese equity market before what is mostly a holiday week this week, rebounding quite sharply. It'd be interesting to see if there's any meat on the bone for what exactly is around that stimulus measure. And then actually, I'm going to make you make one final thought. And that is that goes back into the theme. If they are stimulating, it'll have to be in a way that's a bit less broad based, I would argue, than previous stimulus cycles because of the physical limits of the world. I mean, it's one thing to stimulate back in, for example, 2015 when the stronger dollar had sort of collapsed the oil price and we were in a very different place in terms of the commodity import bill for China. But with the physical realities of this world now, maybe that stimulus potential is somewhat constrained relative to previous cycles, or how should we read this?
I think you're absolutely right, and I think it's a valid point that we're moving to a Chinese world which is going to adapt to the deglobalization. That means that a lot of the initiatives will not be like in the old days on real estate and other things, but it will be strategic in nature. It will be to safeguard the financial system, the assets of the Chinese state. It will be to safeguard the technology they are self-supplying in everything that happens. So China will, to a large extent through the investment, accelerates the deglobalization and the split between the West and the East. And as such, I think China, having been the single biggest deflationary force through their division of labor, cheap labor, but also through the fact that they still produce a majority of their electricity in their plants through coal. So there will be a huge shift that will be first coming as an impulse fiscally, but that impulse strategically will be placed as a bet on China to wean itself off dependency of the rest of the world, which must mean that the impact to the rest of the world will be smaller, which I guess is also your conclusion, John.
Yes, and important points there on the longer term prospects for inflation as well, reshoring of supply chains, perhaps in other developed markets, but then China, by the same token, looking for some form of autarky or at least ability to be self-sufficient in key areas. So that redundancy need has to be built in, and redundancy has a cost, and some of that cost to be in inflation. That's a great point. All right, I think we'll wrap it up there, Stane. Thanks very much for this special edition interview. We hope you found it useful. And of course, look for us to resume our normal daily Saxo Market Calls from here. All the best.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.